Greetings, brethren. Chag HaSukkot Sameach. Happy Feast of Tabernacles. Really love both of those songs. They're just very inspiring. Enjoy them immensely. Very thankful for them. And did a great job on that. I might mention before I get started about those festival booklets for the youth over there. There is one for teens. I thought there was because I saw a... I saw it when it had the bigger label on it. When I picked up the book over there, it says festival booklet and it says teen about as tiny as you could possibly write it. It's maybe 8-point type. I'm not sure, but it's on there, so they are up there for you as well. I'm sure a lot of work went into these, so they'd like everybody to get them that could. Well, we've had a great few days so far. My wife and I and the rest of our family got here a few days early, and we've done a few fun things. We went to Wild World next to Walmart, which I thought was going to be just a little tiny thing, but it's kind of cool. I definitely recommend that you get over and see that if you get a chance to, because they have wolves there and mountain lions, and it's kind of a neat place to see. We also went to see Samson, which was a spectacle to behold. We've seen a few shows over there, and it is just amazing. And I would say there was a few things I was even wondering, is that really in Scripture? Of course, they embellish these stories, but there was a few things I had not noticed before that I went back later and I looked, and indeed it was in there. But there's probably a few things we wouldn't agree with, but it's very thought-provoking, I'll just say that. I definitely recommend it as something to see. Quite an amazing thing. Well, my sermon... Oh, before I get... Another thing, I was told I need to plug my Bible study that's coming up on Friday night. And you might notice in there that it's the only, Mr. Giddens was kind enough to point this out, is the only thing that's listed in there that does not have an end time. It starts at 7:30, but there's no end time, so no fear. It should end at 9, I'll just say that. And big focus on the word should there, but no, it's... That's when we'll try to end it then. I mean, the only thing is there might be some people who might want to talk to me afterward, and that I'm sure that'll be fine. But as far as the official thing, I think we'll end it then at 9. Well, my sermon this afternoon is about temporary dwellings. There's nothing surprising about that. As we all know, that's why we're here. But let's examine the matter a little bit. I've titled the message, Five Aspects of Temporary Dwellings. Five aspects of temporary dwellings. Turn with me, if you would, to Leviticus 23, where God lays out his seven festivals. Leviticus 23, remarkable chapter, you know, by the way, that it just lays them all out together there. There's only one other place where they're laid out all together, and that's in Numbers 28 and 29, where it's talking about the offerings to give on these various days. But here we have a little more of the meat of what these are about. And notice God's instructions to the Israelites regarding how they were to observe the particular festival that we are keeping, the Feast of Tabernacles, and why. Leviticus 23, verses 40 through 43, verses 40 through 43. It says, "And you shall take for yourselves on the first day the fruit of beautiful trees, branches of palm trees, the boughs of leafy trees, and willows of the brook. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days." And skipping ahead, verse 42 here, "You shall dwell in booths for 7 days. All who are native Israelites shall dwell in booths, that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God." The Hebrew for booth is sukkah, a tabernacle or a tent, a temporary dwelling. And the plural is Sukkot, which is the Jewish name for the festival. Actually, Chag HaSukkot is in the scriptures there, the Feast of the Tabernacles. These Israelites, when they came out, I mean, they had been in a lot of bad conditions, of course, in their enslavement. But they had homes in Egypt. You know, they put the blood on the doorposts, but now they didn't have doorposts. They were on the move. They were out in the wilderness. And they were sojourners, constantly on the move, living in tents. And even God's tabernacle was just that, you know, through the wilderness, wanderings later, a tabernacle or tent, a temporary dwelling for God, until they built the temple structure, which actually was still temporary, as it turns out. We'll talk about that a little bit more. But brethren, today I want to cover five symbolic aspects of festival booths. Five symbolic aspects of festival booths. And number one, let's get right into it, is that booths represent escaping this world and sojourning with God. Escaping this world and sojourning with God. You know, again, we just saw here in Leviticus 23:43, God said to dwell in booths, and very specifically, that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. But we can put a focus on that. When I brought them out from where they were no longer in this civilization. They were out here on the move. They came out following the cloud. And while they were doing this, they were hiking and they were camping. They were in the wild outdoors, as it were, getting away from it all, so to speak. We might think of it that way today. They were getting away from something. They were getting away from the ways of this world and its evils and the society that they were in. Following this cloud, wherever it led them, I'd like you to turn over to Exodus 13, if you will. Exodus 13. I mean, it was there from the moment they left, Exodus 13. It says in verses 21 through 22, Exodus 13, 21 through 22, and the Lord went before them. So God was leading them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire. We hear about that in the singing, to give them light so as to go by day and night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people. And where did the Lord first lead them? Where did they stop initially? Initially, they gathered at this place called Ramesses. And later, I think that was a later name, but it's called here in Scripture, Ramesses, is the gathering place where they organized. And then they left from there. And it says in Exodus 12, you look back at chapter here, Exodus 12, verse 37. Exodus 12:37 says, then the children of Israel journeyed from Ramesses to Succoth. About 600,000 men on foot besides children. We're looking at maybe 2-3 million people leaving Egypt. The Hebrew name Succoth here probably was named for their encampment at this place. I mean, it's not something the Egyptians really call it. This is what the Hebrews named it when they camped there. At this stage, we might want to think about this too, there were probably a lot of makeshift dwellings, including whatever branches and bushes could be found, maybe some palm trees. Thought of maybe bringing some palm trees out, but a little bit of an effort to carry these around. But they had to lug stuff around, I think, a little bit too when they first came out. You know, we may think of actual tents like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had, but these departing slaves may not have had many of these kinds of tents among them yet. It would take time to make goat hair tents and other such shelters. Remember, they didn't live in that when they were in Egypt. So we see the need for branches to make lean-tos, basically. But how could there have been enough for all of these people in the desert wandering? It seems the land wasn't as barren then, maybe as it is now, but it was evidently still pretty barren. Done hydrology studies and try to figure out what the rainfall was like back then. So another one of those Exodus miracles, that there was even enough foliage about to be able to do this. Later, after they crossed the Red Sea, it mentions in Numbers 33 that they stopped at a place with 70 palm trees, although that still wouldn't really be enough, would it? I mean, we're talking a lot of people, 2-3 million people, as we said. But I'm guessing they were, again, dragging along some of what they found for shelter for a while. And then they got to Sinai, and they were there for a year. And then they probably had time to produce more proper tents. But these still weren't permanent structures, as they would soon be on the move again, following the cloud. And I should mention that the Jews viewed the covering of the pillar of cloud as the Succoth, as the temporary shelters for the days in the wilderness. And it was that as well. Although we know they definitely had physical structures as well, but you know, for them to really be protected out there, they needed that covering, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But let's look at Numbers 9. You can see the wondering that was going on. Numbers 9. In Numbers 9, verse 15, we'll start in Numbers 9, 15, go into verse 23. It says, "Now on the day that the tabernacle was raised up," so this is after they had built, you know, God's temporary dwelling there, "the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony. From evening until morning, it was above this cloud, pillar of cloud and fire was above the tabernacle like the appearance of fire. So it was always. The cloud covered it by day and the appearance of fire by night. Whenever the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle, after that, the children of Israel would journey. And in the place where the cloud settled, there the children of Israel would pitch their tents." And, you know, by this point, I'm sure they had, you know, more proper tents. "At the command of the Lord, the children of Israel would journey, and at the command of the Lord, they would camp. As long as the cloud stayed above the tabernacle, they remained encamped. Even when the cloud continued long, many days above the tabernacle, the children of Israel kept the charge of the Lord and did not journey. So it was when the cloud was above the tabernacle a few days, according to the command of the Lord, they would remain encamped, and according to the command of the Lord, they would journey." So it was when the cloud remained, really want to get this now, we're going to say this a number of times, when it remained only from evening until morning, when the cloud was taken up in the morning, then they would journey. Whether by day or by night, whenever the cloud was taken up, they would journey. Whether it was 2 days, a month, or a year that the cloud remained above the tabernacle, the children of Israel would remain encamped and not journey. But when it was taken up, they would journey. At the command of the, so whenever they didn't know when it was going to happen, when it was going to stop, when it was going to go. But whenever it did, either of those, they had to stop or go with it. At the command of the Lord, they remained encamped, and at the command of the Lord, they journeyed. They kept the charge of the Lord at the command of the Lord by the hand of Moses. So the Israelites were sojourning. They were traveling through. And by the way, so was God here. He was leading them, in, and he had a temporary dwelling that they would move along, and he stayed there with them, and they were journeying through the wilderness this way. And they were still sojourners even after they entered the promised land. I think we'll hear more about that later in the feast, about this idea of being sojourners. But one thing that was mentioned today is very interesting. Mr. Dick was talking about the land belongs to God when they got to the promised land. You know, it says in Leviticus 25, I'll just refresh your memory on this. Leviticus 25:23 says, "The land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. For you are strangers and sojourners with me." But what's very interesting about that is, again, that it says, "You are strangers and sojourners with me." Now, you can say, well, that's because they were staying in his land. That's true, it was. He owned all the land. He owns the world. God owns everything. And he certainly owned that land. And it's going to be the land of the Holy Land forever. But what's very interesting is that the people, even when they were there in that land that belonged to them, they were still regarded as strangers and sojourners with God. And we see that also in 1 Chronicles 29, if you flip over there, 1 Chronicles 29. This is something that David prayed after the Israelites brought offerings to build the temple. This is what he said to God, you know, in acknowledgement of what we just saw. 1 Chronicles 29:15. David prayed, "For we are aliens and pilgrims before you, as were all our fathers. Our days on earth are as a shadow and without hope." So this is very interesting that, again, these people, they come to their homeland, but they're still regarded as they're traveling through. This isn't really their ultimate homeland, as it were. And it's not for any, it wasn't for them, and it's not for us. We're going to see that too. Now, Solomon built the temple of God as a symbol of future permanence. A symbol of future permanence, not because permanence had actually been achieved. The transition from David's reign to Solomon's reign was a type of the coming of the kingdom, in a way. Because what you had was David's time was this time of a lot of warfare going on and subduing the enemies. And so maybe, you know, if you think right at the beginning of the millennium, you'll have a subduing of the enemies. And then you have a kingdom of peace. And Solomon's name, it means son of peace. His reign was a time of peace. It's not because he was, you know, a weakling or anything and wasn't able to fight in war. He could have defeated any enemies. But he did not need to, because that had already been done at the time of David. So David was not allowed to build the temple. It's interesting. David was not allowed to build the temple because he was a man of war. That doesn't mean David was a bad guy. It's because, and we know he wasn't. But it really, the idea here is because David, what his time symbolized was not the time for the permanence of the temple, which would represent the millennial reign, whereas it was the time of this warfare when they needed to cease for that temple to exist there at that time. But it was all symbolic, because obviously that temple did not last, and Solomon blew it. He did not carry out a millennial reign of sorts that he should have, because he did not stay in the way of God as he should have, as the ultimate Prince of Peace will do. He will lead us into a true righteous age. Now, 1 Peter 2:11, I would just mention to you, in the New Testament, 1 Peter 2:11 calls Christians sojourners and pilgrims. So that's a title for us, too. We are sojourners and pilgrims. And if you think about the Israelites following the cloud out there in the wilderness, we follow Christ wherever he goes. That's what we're supposed to do. If wherever he leads us, we follow. We go that way. And he's taking us through different places in the world. He's certainly taken us even through different organizations some of us have been through along the way. Wherever the truth of God has settled, that's where we camp. And if it moves, then we take up the stakes and we go on to wherever God goes. He's leading us through the wilderness, and we are following him wherever he goes, looking forward to the day when we arrive at our final destination, the kingdom of God. And when at last Christ returns, we will be delivered from this world, just as ancient Israel was delivered from Egypt. The only difference is Egypt was still there. This world is going to be eliminated and replaced. Not instantly, but fairly soon this world is going to be replaced with the promised land of God, the kingdom of God, that is going to be a joyful time. So in that sense, we will have left this world to be with God. And that is that is an important symbolism of this festival. Number two is that booths represent God's protection. Booths represent God's protection. I'd like you to turn over to Isaiah 4. Isaiah chapter 4. And this is part of a passage that is very heavily related to the Feast of Tabernacles. We're going to come back to this at the end of the sermon, but I want to read part of this now. Isaiah 4, verses 5 through 6, this is when Christ's kingdom is established here. It says, "Then the Lord will create above every dwelling place of Mount Zion and above her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a covering." A huppah in the Hebrew. The huppah, they have these at Jewish wedding ceremonies, this covering there that you have to be under. And I think there's a relationship to that as well here with the marriage that will be taking place. But over all the glory, there will be a covering and there will be a tabernacle. The word here is a sukkah. There will be a sukkah for shade in the daytime from the heat, for a place of refuge and for a shelter from storm and rain. What is it talking about? It just said there's going to be a cloud and smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night over as a covering. The pillar of cloud and fire, brethren, is coming back. It's coming back. And it's going to be over Jerusalem during the millennium, where Christ will be reigning and we will be there with him. It's going to be an awesome thing. And it's going to provide refuge from heat, a shelter from storm and rain. Now, Sukkot booths are shelters. And the pillar of cloud and fire was a shelter. God's protection from heat, storm, and rain. You know, as I mentioned, the Jews view the pillar of cloud as the wilderness shelters, or Sukkot, more than the physical shelters that they put together. Of course, the physical materials were useful, but they would not have been effective without God's overarching protection. It's kind of like we sing from Psalm 127:1, unless the Lord shall build the house, the weary builders toil in vain. Unless the Lord, the city shields, the guards maintain a useless watch. If God's protection was not over the Israelites, these little shelters that they built would not have protected them. They would not have survived. There's some interesting imagery in Revelation 7 I'd like you to look over at. Revelation 7. Very often we think of this symbolism of the palm branches and these things that they took at the time of the Feast of Tabernacles as something that's Old Testament. Or maybe we say, well, it's in the New Testament when they all laid down the palm branches for Jesus as he came into Jerusalem in the triumphal entry. But we see another picture of this in the end time. Revelation 7, verse 9, talking about this great multitude who comes to follow God here at the very end. After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude, which no one could number, of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, with palm branches in their hands. This is Feast of Tabernacles imagery right here, the rejoicing with the palm branches. And notice verse 16. Verse 16 says about these people, they shall neither hunger anymore nor thirst anymore. The sun shall not strike them, nor any heat. Now that is quoting Isaiah 49, verse 10. Isaiah 49, verse 10 is describing the return of the Israelite exiles from afar, coming back to their land, and it says they'll be, you know, given the springs of waters, and the sun won't strike them, nor any heat, and they'll be back under God's protection. And these people here are under God's protection, coming in a massive return to God, to be under God's protection and care. And that's what is symbolized, again, by these booths. And brethren, we are under God's protection and care in this age, and will continue to be for eternity as we are transformed into his likeness. Number three, booths represent harvest shacks. What in the world am I talking about? Booths represent harvest shacks. Turn to Exodus 23. Exodus 23. It ties in with the Feast of Ingathering. The Feast of Ingathering. Exodus 23. Actually, this is one of a couple places that tells us that the Feast of Tabernacles has this harvest name. You know, we have the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is was at the time of the barley harvest, or right at when they would take the first, the wave sheaf offering of the barley harvest. And then you had a harvest period of grain until Pentecost. And that's mentioned here at the beginning of Exodus 23:16. And the Feast of Harvest, the first fruits of your labors which you've sown in the field. That's talking about Pentecost. It's a harvest festival. And the Feast of Ingathering at the end of the year when you have gathered in the fruit of your labors from the field. And gathering the fruit is also mentioned there in Leviticus 23. So this festival is a feast of gathering in the harvest. Agriculturally, of course, we're, you know, and in Israel, by the way, it's a little bit earlier, this late harvest than it is over here. I mean, we have stuff still growing into the fall, and we have Thanksgiving. We have this harvest festival, being thankful for this harvest period that's been completed. But over there, it's a little bit earlier. And so you had this time of bringing in this great harvest. But of course, that symbolizes the harvest of humanity. And you have the earlier harvest in the time of the spring festivals. And you have here in the fall, the celebration of this great end time harvest. Now look at Isaiah 1, if you would. Isaiah chapter 1. And I'm going to show something interesting about this. Isaiah chapter 1. And this is talking about bad things that were going to come upon Judah because the nation was in rebellion against God, was not doing as it should. And it says in verse 8, verse 7 talks about the country is desolate, cities burned with fire. We heard about that too, but verse 8. So the daughter of Zion is left as a booth, a sukkah, in a vineyard, as a hut in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city. I mean, the idea is it's going to be pretty ravaged, and there's only going to be like a few standing structures here and there, and it compares it to like a booth in a vineyard. Now, what is that talking about? Well, again, this was a shelter from the heat of the sun and from rain and storm if it came early. It was a place of temporary rest during the labor of harvest. When they carried out the harvest, they would build these ramshackle structures out here to hang out in as they needed to from heat and rain and rest. And this this was very much like what you would have in this idea when they built the booths as well. And it's called a booth, a sukkah, as it says. But of course, that was, again, a real thing physically that they did, but it looked forward to the millennial and last judgment period harvest of people of all nations. When we who are training today will then be working in the field of this earth to help bring in God's great end time harvest. If you think about it, it's pretty amazing that they would have these booths set up for harvest. And there will be a great harvest, and the idea is that the temporary dwellings are to picture that time of harvest. Number four, booths represent fleeting yet abundant existence. Booths represent fleeting yet abundant existence. The Jewish people see in the physical sukkah or booth a symbol of human frailty. When they build their booths, they maintain that the structure of the temporary dwelling must be flimsy. And one place they take that from is over in Genesis 33. If you look over at Genesis 33, we see another account of a place being named Sukkot. Genesis 33, verse 17, talking about Jacob. And it says, Jacob journeyed to Sukkot. And you think, oh, there was a place that was already called that. No, actually we find in this verse, again, he named it that. Or somebody did because he did that. It says, Jacob journeyed to Sukkot, to a place called a booth, a tabernacle basically, built himself a house and made Sukkot, booths, for his livestock. Therefore, the name of the place is called Sukkot. Now notice that. He built himself a house, so that's, you know, a more major structure. And he says, and he made Sukkot for his livestock. So these are like the stables, the more the temporary type structures that he made. In fact, in referring to a sukkah as a temporary dwelling, we should consider it more as a temporary structure, not a permanent dwelling that we reside in temporarily, but the nature of the structure is temporary. I mean, you can see it from this verse very, very clearly. But I'll note something about that in just a moment. But before I do, I want to mention something else. I'd like you to turn over to Nehemiah 8. I want to interject an odd fact here, which is that the Israelites apparently did not build booths for 1,000 years in their observance of the Feast of Tabernacles. Nehemiah 8 and they had discovered the Book of the Law, and they found out they weren't doing things right, so they observed the Feast of Trumpets. And then it says in verse 13, Nehemiah 8:13. Now on the second day, the heads of the fathers' houses of all the people with the priests and Levites were gathered to Ezra the scribe in order to understand the words of the law. And they found written in the law which the Lord had commanded by Moses that the children of Israel should dwell in booths in Sukkot during the feast of the seventh month. And that they should announce and proclaim in all their cities and in Jerusalem, saying, go out to the mountain and bring olive branches, branches of oil trees, myrtle branches, palm branches, and branches of leafy trees to make booths, as it is written. Then the people went out and brought them and made themselves booths, each one on the roof of his house or in their courtyards or the courts of the house of God and in the open square of the water gate and the open square of the gate of Ephraim. So they made these booths all over the place. And it says, so the whole assembly of those who had returned from the captivity made booths and sat under the booths. Now here's the amazing statement. For since the days of Joshua, the son of Nun, until that day, the children of Israel had not done so. And there was very great gladness. Also, day by day, from the first day until the last day, he read from the book of the law of God. And they kept the feast 7 days, and on the eighth day there was a sacred assembly according to the prescribed manner. Now this is odd to read, because the returning exiles previously kept the Feast of Tabernacles in Ezra 3:4. You can flip back to Ezra 3:4, and when they came into the land, they kept the Feast of Tabernacles. But here it says they had not done this since the time of Joshua. And so what does this mean? Solomon dedicated God's temple in a two-week period that included the Feast of Tabernacles. So the Israelites had been observing the Feast of Booths, but apparently not with booths. And that includes righteous kings like David, which is astonishing. Maybe they just thought that the palm and other branches were for waving and rejoicing, while the commandment about booths was satisfied by tents, or maybe they didn't think they needed to have booths. It could be that they thought they were already under a sukkah, since they had the pillar of cloud and fire there at the tabernacle and then the temple. And we might note that in the second temple period of Ezra's day, they did not have the pillar of cloud and fire anymore. But at the time of Ezra, this aspect of worship, actually building booths, was restored. Now, today people don't typically stay in an actual booth for the festival or even a tent, as in past years. People usually opt for nicer accommodations, seeing the need for luxurious dwelling to rejoice in. We're commanded to rejoice at the feast. And sometimes it's not so joyful to be in a booth. Of course, even this imposing structure around us could be blown flat by natural causes. Auditoriums and hotels may be sturdier than lean-tos, shacks, or tents, but ultimately, they too are still temporary. Brethren, everything we see is temporary. Now, on the rejoicing side, it should be recognized that even a Jewish sukkah, though temporary and frail, can still be splendid and sumptuous. It is, after all, as they explain, a symbol of God's protection, hearkening back to the time they dwelt beneath the protective covering of the pillar of cloud and fire. Even God's tabernacle was a sukkah, and it was very rich and splendid. Indeed, we often speak of temporary quarters for the feast as typifying royal dwellings, and they should, as God's tabernacle did. Still, all physical things are temporary. Considering that the Jews view booths as representative of human frailty, it's interesting to note that the New Testament explains our physical bodies are tents or tabernacles, temporary dwellings. Look at 2 Corinthians 5, if you would. 2 Corinthians 5, verses 1 through 5. But 2 Corinthians 5, verses 1 through 5 says, "For we know that if our earthly house, this tent, is destroyed, we have a building from God." So again, our body, our physical body, is this tent, earthly house. "We have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this we groan, earnestly desiring," thank you much, "to be clothed with our habitation which is from heaven, if indeed, having been clothed, we shall not be found naked. For we who are in this tent groan, being burdened, not because we want to be unclothed, but further clothed, that mortality may be swallowed up by life. Now he who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who has also given us the Spirit as a guarantee." And he could also turn over to 2 Peter 1:13-14. 2 Peter 1:13-14. Peter says, "Yes, I think it is right, as long as I am in this tent, to stir you up by reminding you, knowing that shortly I must put off my tent, just as our Lord Jesus Christ showed me." So our earthly bodies are compared to these temporary tents that are going to be put off when we take on a new spiritual body that is going to come at the resurrection. But we think, well, are we supposed to have a miserable, horrible life in this physical tent? Sometimes things don't go so well and we have to endure. But God intends that even our physical lives be abundant and prosperous. We see that in John 10:10. I've come that they may have life more abundantly. In 3 John 2, I pray that you may prosper and be in health. This is what God generally wants for us, although sometimes he also has us go through difficulties for our ultimate betterment. But the point being is that you can have this temporary existence that is also richly rewarding and a blessing. And that's part of what is symbolized here, fleeting yet abundant existence. And of course, this very much ties into what Mr. Barry Howdy Show was saying in the sermonette about making the most of a short feast. As we need to make the most of our fleeting physical lives in general, I have something on this point we included in the United Church of God Bible Reading Program commentary that I recently finished on Ecclesiastes, and we've now published this online, that goes very well with this idea about a fleeting yet abundant existence. This festival, this is quoting the Bible Reading Program, also fits well with the fleeting nature of life today. Commentator James Lindberg puts it well in Encountering Ecclesiastes, A Book for Our Time, on page 123. Sukkot, or tabernacles, is a celebration of the beauty of things that don't last. The little hut, which is so vulnerable to wind and rain and will be dismantled at week's end. The ripe fruits, which will spoil if not picked and eaten right away. The friends who may not be with us for as long as we would wish. And in northern climates, the beauty of the leaves changing color as they begin the process of dying and falling from the trees. Sukkot comes in the fall. Summer is over, and sometimes the evenings are already chilly with the first whispers of winter. It comes to tell us that the world is full of good and beautiful things, food and wine, flowers and sunsets and autumn landscapes and good company to share them with, but that we have to enjoy them right away, because they will not last. They will not wait for us to finish other things and get around to them. It's a time to eat our bread in gladness and drink our wine with joy, Ecclesiastes 9:7. Not despite the fact that life does not go on forever, but precisely because of that fact. It is a time to enjoy happiness with those we love and to realize that we're at a time in our lives when enjoying today means more than worrying about tomorrow. It is a time to celebrate the fact that we have finally learned what life is about and how to make the most of it. That's the end of that quote, but we also noted, of course, in observing the Feast of Tabernacles, while we are learning to appreciate our many blessings today, we're also anticipating the permanence of life and joy yet to come. So, again, it's fleeting. The feast is fleeting, but it's a time of abundance. And that was meant to be symbolized also in the booths that were dwelt in during this time. Number five, booths represent the millennial period. Booths represent the millennial period. And we understand, brethren, in the way the plan of God is laid out, that the Feast of Tabernacles represents the time of the millennium, when God's kingdom will be set up on this earth. What might seem odd, though, is why that period would be symbolized by temporary dwellings. Temporary dwellings would seem to symbolize our time here and now, you know, like in our physical body at this time, not the time of the millennium. Now, it could perhaps be argued that the point is to make us mindful of our current temporary dwellings so as to make us long for our future permanent dwellings. And indeed, there may be some truth in that. But it seems more germane to the feast to consider this fact. The millennial period itself, along with the white throne judgment period that follows it, is temporary. It, too, is a time of temporary dwellings or booths. Albeit the grandest, most wonderful, most prosperous and abundant temporary period ever. Of course, when we are changed at the resurrection at Christ's return, our spirit bodies will then be permanent, incorruptible dwellings. But the rest of mankind will still dwell in physical, fleshly bodies. And even for us, when we're spirit beings, there will still be an aspect of temporary dwelling. Our dwelling place at that time, the surface of the earth, including the millennial temple in Jerusalem, will all be temporary. 1,000 or 1,100 years, yes, but still temporary. It is all going to be replaced at the time of the new heavens and new earth and the new Jerusalem for which we wait, as described in Revelation 21 through 22. Remember what God said of Abraham. Turn over to Hebrews 11, if you will. Hebrews 11. What God said of Abraham here in Hebrews 11, verses 8 through 10. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he dwelt in the land of promise, as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. And I find that very interesting. It's making a point that they were in tents in this sort of a temporary nomadic existence. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. It is the same for us, brethren. And it will still be that way through the millennium. Even while we are spirit beings in the millennium, our permanent home, the New Jerusalem, will still be waiting in heaven yet to descend to the earth. While we work in the field of this earth, reaping the great and gathering harvest of the world to come. It is an amazing and wonderful picture. Notice this too from the end of the millennium, when Satan is released and leads the Gog and Magog forces against God's followers. Turn over to Revelation 20, if you will. We'll notice something there. Revelation 20. And, Satan's going to lead all these forces against God's people at that time. It says Revelation 20, verse 9. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. Notice that. Here's the beloved city of Jerusalem where they're gathered around. But it's referred to as the camp of the saints. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. But it's a camp. It is a temporary dwelling that will be there at that time. Still, even though the millennial world and the millennial temple itself will be temporary, awaiting the new heavens and the new earth and the new Jerusalem, our wandering on this earth will at last be over. I mean, we will no longer have a nomadic, wandering, sojourning existence at that time, in an ultimate sense, because we'll be where we're going to be forever, even though that new city is still yet to come down. Turn over to Isaiah 33. And we'll see a mention of this. Isaiah 33. When we're finally reestablished there in Jerusalem. Isaiah 33, verse 20. It says, look upon Zion. And by the way, we want a context for this. Verse 17, it says, your eyes will see the king in his beauty. And they will see the land that is far off. You will see it. And then it's going to be that there's going to be something amazing about this place. Verse 20, look upon Zion, the city of our appointed feast. Your eyes will see Jerusalem, a quiet home, a tabernacle that will not be taken down. Not one of its stakes will ever be removed, nor will any of its cords be broken. That's where it's going to be. That's where we will forever be. We'll be at the place. But, of course, that's still a tabernacle waiting for that new Jerusalem to come down to that very place where we will be forever. And in conclusion, brethren, turn back finally, if you would, to Isaiah 4. I really like turning to this verse during the feast. I think it kind of brings a lot of the imagery together about the description of the feast. And Isaiah, we read it, but we'll read more of it this time, going through here. We'll read verses 2 through 6. Isaiah 4, verse 2, "In that day, the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and appealing for those of Israel who have escaped." This is actually, again, Feast of Tabernacles issue. We see a branch and fruit, beautiful fruit. This is exactly what was described there in Leviticus 23. But the branch here is Christ. And the fruit is the blessings and righteousness of God's people. Verse 3, "And it shall come to pass that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy, everyone who is recorded among the living in Jerusalem, when the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and purged the blood of Jerusalem from her midst by the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning." There's going to be a terrible, ominous, destructive time coming. But it's going to purify people. Those who are left will all be holy, it says. Then, verse 5, "Then the Lord will create above every dwelling place of Mount Zion and above her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a covering and there will be a tabernacle," again a sukkah, "for shade in the daytime from the heat, for a place of refuge, for a shelter from storm and rain." That, brethren, is the millennial tabernacle. We sing of it in one of our hymns. "Glorious things of thee are spoken, Zion, city of our God. Round each habitation hovering, see the cloud and fire appear for a glory and a covering, showing that the Lord is near." How amazing that will be. This will be our awesome home, yet still joyfully awaiting the permanence yet to come. And for this and all God gives, we rejoice. So while we're here rejoicing at this feast, let's be mindful of these aspects of booths or tabernacles. Escaping this world and sojourning with God. Being under God's protection. Finding shelter and rest while laboring in God's great harvest of humanity. Experiencing fleeting yet abundant and joyful existence. And picturing the most awesome time of temporary dwellings ever, the millennium, while awaiting the eternal permanence of the new heavens and new earth and new Jerusalem yet to come. Brethren, what a wonderful world is in store under the rule and protection of the great God, indeed of the God family, which will include us if we remain faithful. Have a wonderful and uplifting feast of temporary dwellings.